This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We've spent a lot of time this week on WBUR talking about the human brain and what our brain chemistry might tell us about our depression, anxiety, and other mental health issues. And now we're going to focus on the brains of different species.
Birds, cats, whales, chimps, and many other types of animals can all experience mental illness that often mirror our own symptoms. Laurel Brakeman experienced that when she adopted a 4-year-old Bernese Mountain Dog named Oliver. His very troubled behavior convinced her and Oliver's veterinarians that the dog was emotionally unstable.
And that diagnosis led her to travel the world in search of mentally disturbed animals and the people who care for them. The result is her new book, Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Laurel Brakeman finished her PhD in history and anthropology at MIT last year, and she joins us now in the studio. Laurel, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And listeners, we are eager to hear from you on this. We want to know if you feel like you've seen in your own pets cases of mental illness. What kind of symptoms do you see? To what extent do you think we're responsible for animals' depression or anxiety, as we'll be talking about with Laurel? Part of the question is whether the lives we make them live might not be the lives they are born to live, and maybe that factors into why they might have some problems. So let us know what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Laurel, this book would not have happened without your dog, Oliver. So let's start with his story. Would you tell us what it was that Oliver was doing that made you and his vets think he had a mental illness?
Well, it was the change in his behavior. His first 6 months with us were a dream. He was affectionate and friendly and playful. And about 6 months in, he developed devastating separation anxiety. He couldn't be left alone because he basically became a ball of terror and quaked in anxiety anytime he was by himself. He also became aggressive with small dogs. He developed a range of OCD-like behaviors where he would lick himself to injury, and he started to eat things that weren't food.
Did your vets say what they thought was going on, why he suddenly started to do this?
Yes. Actually, I should say they didn't know why he started to do this, but they had diagnoses for me. They diagnosed him with canine obsessive compulsive disorder and thunderstorm anxiety and separation anxiety.
And what was the treatment?
All kinds of things. A lot of it I did myself before taking him to a veterinary behaviorist. So behavioral training, things like trying to teach him that when we left the house, we would come back again so that he could trust us and feel confident when he was left alone. We also had to give him a range of psychopharmaceuticals, liver-flavored Prozac and Valium in particular.
You know, before I read your book, I know people who have dogs that take, or even cats that take anti-anxieties. I did not know they were flavored for animals in some cases. That's actually custom-tailored, like drug mixing for pets.
Absolutely. You can take them to a compounding pharmacy and you can get all kinds of flavors. Or you can order them online and everything from like anchovy and peanut butter to tutti frutti and watermelon, depending on your creature's tastes.
So going through this with your dog made you want to look at other animals. And you looked all over the world and you really began to find that this is a common theme. Gorillas dying from homesickness, bears with heartbreak. What else did you see?
Yes, those are historical examples. And what I found was that the history of insanity in other animals really clearly paralleled our own. So if you look back in history and you see that people were thought to die of heartbreak or homesickness or nostalgia, there was a whole range of creatures who were suffering from the same things at the same time and made headlines in the newspapers. And today, the same thing is true. Children can be diagnosed with separation anxiety, and so can our dogs. We can be diagnosed with OCD, and so can our other animals.
Should we be surprised by that? I mean, many animals are highly intelligent. Should we be surprised that they also have emotional, mental similarities to our own?
No, I don't think we should be too surprised, and yet we are.
So one of the sub-headline of your book, it talks about how learning this can help us understand ourselves. What do you think the link is? If we see these problems in animals, how do we then learn more about ourselves and our mental health?
Well, I think that this happens in a number of different ways. The first thing that I discovered, you know, I was a history student, and so I was looking at historical examples. And what I came to pretty quickly was that most of what we know about the unhinged human mind, we learned from our experiences with other animals first, with them both as test subjects and also just how they reacted to their daily lives alongside of us. So things like emotional resiliency, we learned from Pavlov's experiments on dogs. We learned that human children develop more successfully not just with food and shelter, but also with affection from Harry Harlow's work on monkeys in the 1950s and 60s in Wisconsin. So much of what we take for granted about what we know about the human mind, particularly when we're suffering, we actually proved those theories first in other creatures.
And in your research, Laurel, did you learn what causes mental illness in animals? Is it sometimes they were born with a genetic tweak that made them that way? Was it something they went through in their lives, whether they're captive animals or wild animals, that triggered this?
It's a mixture of all those things, and what I came to is that it's the same as the answer to the question in humans, which is we don't know what causes mental illness in humans. You know, it's a whole cornucopia of things, and the same can be true of other animals. People do often ask me, though, is it just animals who've been abused and mistreated by people? And that is absolutely not true. That can trigger a disturbing behavior in another animal, but lots of creatures who have been raised in the same house, who've been treated fairly and justly and with lots of affection and tender loving care can lose their minds.
And not even pets or domestic animals, but you found what you consider mental illness in wild animals.
Yes, absolutely. Oftentimes, though, when you notice an odd behavior in a wild animal, it's because they've come close to a person. So, you know, I don't want to make gross generalizations about non-human nature, because the animals that we can make observations about are noticeable by us. We've come close to them, and that's how we can say things about what they're doing. In general, in order to say that an animal is mentally ill, I think that you have to have a baseline. You have to know an animal's normal before you can understand that something's gone terribly wrong.
One of the unfortunate things that the human race does is sometimes shun people with mental illnesses or not be comfortable around them. Did you find that in the animal world there's a parallel? If an animal is acting as if it has emotional or mental issues, or does it become a pariah animal in its pack?
It depends how it's manifesting. You know, I think a lot of creatures, such as elephants or bonobos, I saw many cases where animals in a herd or in a troop would go out of their way to help another creature. And actually, one of the clearest examples happened here in Boston at the Franklin Park Zoo with the gorilla Gigi.
Which case is that?
She is a lowland gorilla. She lives inside Franklin Park Zoo, and she developed what reminded her psychiatrist here in Boston of PTSD and a panic disorder. And the other female creatures came to her aid over the course of many years. They now protect her from the male that she was scared of, and I think they're largely responsible for her emotional health.
I noticed you also mentioned the Franklin Park Zoo in your book as part of sort of zoo enlightenment, where animals are no longer in concrete cages with no stimulation. And you mentioned that there are signs at the Franklin Park Zoo about why animals are given things to play with, you know, in case people, visitors, wonder why there are plastic tubs or blankets. It's to keep them occupied. I am talking with Laurel Breitman. She is the author of a book called Animal Madness, about the mental health of animals, about emotional issues on animals. We want to hear your stories and your thoughts about this. We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Laurel, we already have some callers, but I have one more question for you before we go to them. I want to read a paragraph from your book. And it's about how people might be responsible for some of the emotional mental issues in animals, particularly pets. And this is on page 219. It says, most urban and suburban dogs are only encouraged to be themselves for a small fraction of the day. In my neighborhood, just outside of San Francisco, the early evening right before sunset is that fraction. You can feel the collective wags of thousands of tails, the expectant panting at the door, the anticipation of the click of the leash on the collar, and then the overwhelming joy of going out. Out. They flood the sidewalks around my house with their pent-up frustrations. Would you pick up from there and finish the rest of that paragraph?
At the park, the humans stand around tossing balls or chatting idly or calling their dog off another's rump. A half hour or an hour later, it's back to the house for dinner, some petting, maybe some television with the humans, and then bed. But this is not enough time for dogs to do dog things, even if they get to do it in the morning, too.
So are we responsible for animals that have anxieties and mental health issues because we put them in crates all day, or we don't let them run around in the backyard, or they have to be penned up inside? Are we doing this?
I think we are doing this, but we're doing it to ourselves, too, both dogs and people. We haven't had time to adapt to the lives that we're living. We both spend too much time pent up inside.
Or sitting in front of a computer.
Exactly. Exactly. I think dogs and people would be happier with less screen time.
So we have many calls. So let's go to Joan calling from Wellesley. And Joan, as you listen to this conversation, tell us about your own experience with animals and their mental health.
Hi. I had two cats. We were a family and had two cats. And one cat passed away, very old. And this cat had been happy. After the first cat passed away, this cat exhibited tremendous anxiety. And she defecated all over the house. and I took her in. All the medical problems were ruled out, and she essentially, I thought we'll make her an outdoor cat. She was too afraid to go out. And this was a noticeable change in behavior. Like the average, I'm a psychologist, but the average layperson could see that it was connected to this other cat dying. And it was like an enormous grief reaction that I, which I feel terribly guilty about, in the end, did not hang in there with her. And finally, after a year or two of this, I put her down.
Oh, what a very sad story. So, Laurel, as you hear this, what happens? What about people who have pets and they see them behaving differently and they want to help them but aren't sure how? What do you do when you have a pet like that going through this?
Well, this is a little bit controversial, but I think the first thing you need to do is identify with your animal. Some people call that anthropomorphization, or the idea of projecting our own human motivations and desires onto other creatures. But in cases like these, I don't think it's shoddy science. I actually think it helps, and we should do all that we can to help them. Part of that is by identifying with them, even if it is seems a little bit unscientific.
Well, this is a very interesting part of your book, because you talk about how some people feel embarrassed if they're kind of talking too human-like to their pets and whispering in their ears. And you said we shouldn't be embarrassed. Maybe that is how we should relate to animals. Do you believe that?
Absolutely. I mean, we all have these private conversations with our pets. We have funny nicknames for them. We have our weird little embarrassing dog voices. And I think we should embrace those things. It actually helps us help them.
Let's go to Deborah calling from Middleborough. And hi, Deborah. Tell us your pet mental health stories.
Well, I had a horse who unfortunately I had to put down last September. She was 29 years old, and she had developed Cushing's disease, which attacks the muscles. And she also had congestive heart failure. Well, we tried to keep her for a little while, but she wasn't happy. So we decided we were going to let her go. Well, I have two other horses. One of them, during the year before we decided to let her go, would run and take care of her and stay with her wherever she was and keep an eye on her. And then she'd run to our other horse to make sure he was all right, too. She's like the babysitter of the two of them. But but when we finally decided to put her down, my horse, Angel, actually tried to jump in the grave with her friend. As the grave was being dug, Bridget was already gone, the one that we lost. And she was running back and forth in the field, calling for her. And then she'd come over and she'd nudge her, trying to get her up and call for her and start running again.
Deborah, that's quite a story. Laurel, have you heard similar stories about animal deaths triggering what appears to be intense grief in other animals?
Absolutely. You know, a place where you see this, I think, much more commonly is actually in marine mammals. So much of stranding behavior we don't understand. When dolphins and whales come up en masse to die on beaches, sometimes they're ill, but often only one in the pod will be ill. And yet you see all of these animals coming up onto land for what certainly will be a certain death. Why they're doing that, we don't always know, but it could be that dolphin or whale culture in these cases is just compelling all of them to be with their wounded or dying companion.
We also have on the line Barbara calling from Cambridge. And Barbara, your thoughts about all this?
Hi. I just have a question or a comment. Have you seen this sort of work in reverse? Sort of taking the case of like a rescue animal who, upon getting away from that situation, is suddenly, you know, much happier, you know, much better. Have you seen mental health work in reverse and animals get over their traumas?
Improved, their health improved when they're brought into a loving home or got put in a better situation?
Yeah. In what ways have you seen that?
Laurel?
Oh, in all ways. I think some of the best use for humans is to be therapy animals for other animals. You know, we tend to think about therapy animals as dogs and jackets that are working, and actually most humans with a distressed animal are therapy animals themselves. I often felt when I was walking my own dog, I needed a working human jacket.
Laura, I have a question for you, which is that you write about kind of these doggy daycares that are very common. Some of them are like a little hotel. It's almost as if a person would go there. But you say that maybe that's not what dogs want. Maybe what they want is a few bales of hay and a bunch of dirt. So are we giving animals what we think they want when in fact it may not be at all what they want?
Sometimes. And then yet for every dog boutique hotel, there's a person who's turned her kitchen into a rabbit sanctuary and, you know, feeds her rabbits lettuce she grew in the backyard from her kitchen floor. So I think there's a whole continuum of us who reach out and try and help the creatures around us or don't. And I think the great thing is that we can learn. We can learn how to be better with our animals.
We also have a caller from Wakefield, and this is Leslie. And Leslie, tell us about your animal mental health observations.
Hi, so I'm actually a psych nurse, and just by coincidence, and my cat, I adopted her from a shelter, and she seemed to exhibit some type of like post-traumatic stress, because I believe she might have been abused, and she would mark constantly on the kitchen floor in one spot. So she would go outside her litter box, and this went on for about 2 or 3 years, and I would just clean it up like 3 or 4 times a day. And we ruled out anything medical, and as a last resort, I had the veterinarian put her on kitty Prozac, which is used for dogs usually, but it can be used for cats. It's called Reconcile, and, you know, it changed her behavior almost overnight. She stopped barking, and she was a lot less anxious. And I thought that was kind of amazing because I really didn't know what to do with her, and I didn't want to put her down. So I just wanted to get the idea out there to people that, you know, we don't want to obviously just use medication as a first resort, but maybe as a last resort before putting the animal down is something that, you know, can work for some animals.
Leslie, thank you very much for that. Laurel, what did you come away from your research feeling about the use of medications that might be mental health and medications for animals?
As that caller mentioned, you know, the final way station for most animals with problems is what the writer David Sedaris has called visiting the youth in Asia. And so the stakes here are actually quite high. If a psychopharmaceutical drug can keep a rabbit or a parrot or a cat who's marking on the carpet out of a shelter where they're going to be euthanized, then I think that that's a good option. But like the caller mentioned, I don't think they should be the first line of defense.
What do you think the first line of defense should be?
Really paying attention to your own behavior and that of your animals and figuring out what's at the root of their troubles. It's easier said than done. It can take months. It can take filming them when you leave the house. It can take taking notes. It can take all kinds of things. But doing a little bit of investigative work in your own home.
For people who really want a pet, maybe a dog, but they're just not home a lot during the day, what do you think people should do so they don't end up with a dog that's so frustrated because it's not with other dogs and it's not outside? It's not living the life that nature sort of laid out for it.
Well, in Japan, they have cat cafes where you can pay to touch a cat that's not your cat. People's homes are so small.
So rather than having your own pet, you kind of spend time with one on a paid basis.
Yes, or people can go to a local animal shelter. They can walk the dogs. There's so much we can do to be around other animals without giving them a life that we know is going to drive them crazy.
The story about Oliver, did it end happily?
Well, it ended happily in that it completely changed my life. I look at all other animals differently, but Oliver since died. He actually died in a panic-related problem. He suffered from bloat. His stomach twisted, and he died sadly and terribly many years ago. But he's completely changed my life. I owe him everything.
In terms of just sort of the work you have done, the books you have written, just everything it's led to?
Absolutely. I see animals differently. You know, when I leave here today and I walk down the street and I see a flock of pigeons go past, you know, I wonder which is the brave pigeon and which is the slightly more anxious pigeon. And, you know, I may sound like a crazy person, but this is true. This work really did change how I saw the rest of the animal kingdom.
It's an incredibly interesting book. So many parts of it that are just completely fascinating. I think it's definitely worth a read. Laurel Breitman is author of Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Laurel finished her PhD in history and anthropology at MIT last year. And Laurel, you'll be reading and signing books at the Harvard Bookstore tomorrow night?
Absolutely.
Is that right? Thank you very much for coming to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we want to go out on the song you're hearing. It's called Milo Minute by the band Grow. Grass Widow. This piece was performed for the gorillas at Boston's Franklin Park Zoo as part of Laurel's Music for Animals project. This is a project in which musicians play for different species, is that right? So you can see a video of the gorillas watching this song as it's played for them by live musicians at our website, radioboston.org.
And we'll end today and this week on Radio Boston with Music for Gorillas. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston. Bye.